I'd like to say hello to all the people in the audience who are just joining us. Today, we will continue with our in-depth investigative reporting series on vaccines, part 4. It's a second opinion that I'm offering, especially at this time when virtually every day we hear something in the news concerning the importance of vaccines. We're told, for instance, right now that the flu vaccine is important for people of all ages. We're also told that virtually every child should be vaccinated. And now there is a new law that is being introduced that would require every woman to undergo a pregnancy test that would see whether or not she is HIV positive. If she is, then her baby would be introduced to AZT vis-a-vis her receiving AZT. And everyone would think that they're doing a good job protecting the public health. A woman who would refuse to take AZT would be considered an unfit mother and forced to take the medication. At no time would they look at the disastrous effects upon the developing fetus and how many babies have been born with all forms of birth abnormalities, including very extended heads like elephant baby heads. That seems not to be the issue. Bureaucracy at its worst. So I'm providing information from which you can make a more reasoned choice. For those individuals who've actually looked carefully at the facts, just the facts, not who do you believe, who is right, who's wrong, but rather what are the actual facts? Can we prove that vaccines are safe and effective? And if so, who are they safe for and who are they effective for? Now, if I suggest that there is no proof that any individual receiving a vaccine will be automatically protected and safe if they with no side effects, there's no doctor, no scientist in America who could refute that. And if you doubt me, ask your physician, or ask the hospital, or ask the school nurse, or ask the school, or ask the college. Ask all these individuals the next time they demand that you have a vaccine to sign this legal document that would state that if you have any adverse effects, you can sue them personally. And if you're not protected, if you should come down with the very condition you're being immunized for, you could sue them personally. Now, if they have such confidence that this is a completely scientific and totally medically feasible procedure, they should have no problem giving you that assurance. See how many of them do. I'm providing you with facts. You can determine whether you want to use it, vaccinate or not. That is your right. But it's interesting when we stop listening to the so-called opinions of authorities and look at simply evidence. My program is evidence-based. It has taken years to accumulate the data. And today I'm going to take you in depth on each vaccine and show you why I'm very concerned that there is no science to support safety and efficacy, and that we have been misled, and that through this misleading, we have adversely affected an entire generation of children in the United States, as well as adults receiving it. It also tells us that if we rely solely upon a vaccine, then we don't have to consider our lifestyle. We don't have to change anything. We don't have to exercise, clean up our diet, deal with stress. We don't have to be concerned about viruses and bacteria and our exposure to them, hygiene. None of that's important because the vaccine will protect us. That's kind of the mindset that many people have about its relationship to vaccine. But all that, as you will see as I go through this report, is really a subterfuge that we are sicker than we've ever been in spite of being over-vaccinated, or possibly because of being over-vaccinated. Let's take a look. The MMR vaccine. You've heard it talked about. It's used in the United States. It's a live vaccine. It's a virus vaccine, meaning they're putting live viruses directly into your body. It contains a weakened, partially inactivated live measles virus grown in cell cultures of chick embryo, a weakened live strain of mumps virus grown in cell cultures of chick embryo, and a weakened Wistar RA27/3 strain of live attenuated rubella virus grown in human diploid cell, W38, a culture originating from the tissues of a fetus aborted in 1964 after the mother was infected with rubella. There's no preservative. MMR vaccine contains the antibiotic neomycin. Sorbitol, hydrolyzed gelatin, these are added as stabilizers, and the live virus measles vaccine, mumps vaccine, and rubella vaccine are also available as a single vaccine, but most often doctors give these vaccines as the MMR, unless single antigens are specified. Then you have the live oral poliovirus vaccine. The live oral polio vaccine is, in the United States, is a mixture of three types of attenuated, meaning weakened or partially inactivated polioviruses, which have been grown in African green tree monkey kidney cell cultures. And the cells are then grown in a medium consisting of a salt solution containing amino acids, antibiotics, and calf serum. After cell growth, the medium is removed and replaced with a medium containing the virus but no calf serum. The vaccine contains antibiotics, streptomycin, neomycin, and sorbitol. And then you have an inactivated polio vaccine. The inactivated polio vaccine used in the United States is a sterile suspension of three types of poliovirus grown in cultures of vero cells, a continuous line of African green monkey kidney cells. The viruses are concentrated, purified, and made non-infectious by inactivation with formaldehyde. That's embalming fluid. The IPV vaccine contains oxythenol and formaldehyde as preservatives, and the antibiotics neomycin, streptomycin, and polymycin. An IPV vaccine uses human diploid cell cultures rather than monkey kidney cells. Then you have the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine, or HIB, and it's a type B vaccine used in the United States today as a polysaccharide conjugate vaccine. It does not contain all the HIB bacteria, just the organism's capsular polysaccharide. And the vaccine is a sterile solution of a conjugate of the oligosaccharides of the capsular antigen. And then you have the hepatitis B. This is what nurses are getting, doctors, and an awful lot of school children. The first hepatitis B vaccines developed in the 1970s were made using the virus isolated from the blood of human chronic hepatitis B carriers. A plasma-derived hepatitis B vaccine was licensed in 1981 and used in high-risk populations in the 1980s until a genetically engineered recombinant hepatitis B vaccine was developed. And today, hepatitis B recombinant vaccine used in the United States is derived from hepatitis B surface antigens produced in yeast cells. And a portion of the hepatitis B virus gene is cloned into the yeast, a common baker's yeast, and the vaccine is produced from cultures of this recombinant yeast strain. The vaccine is treated with formaldehyde, which is embalming fluid, and contains 95% hepatitis B virus surface antigen and 4% yeast protein, aluminum hydroxide, and thimerosal added as a preservative. And then you have the chickenpox vaccine. And chickenpox vaccine is made from the Oncomerc strain of live attenuated varicella virus, and the virus was initially obtained from a child with natural varicella, introduced into human embryonic lung cell cultures, adopted to and propagated in embryonic guinea pig cell cultures, and finally propagated in human diploid cell cultures. And the vaccine contains sucrose, which is sugar, phosphate, glutamate, and processed gelatin as stabilizers. Now, noting the fact that vaccines include a host of undisputed toxins, such as thimerosal, very bad, aluminum phosphate, very bad, formaldehyde, terrible, then we have to be reminded that many of the ill effects caused by vaccines existed at nowhere near today's level 30 years ago. I interviewed Alan Phillips, who's an activist on the issue, and he cites autism, ADD, hyperactivity, dyslexia, and a host of allergies as examples. In his book, What Every Parent Should Know About Childhood Immunization, Jamie Murphy seconds the Phillips view and pulls even fewer punches. Jamie Murphy says, "What sane person would consider using a hazardous waste carcinogenic in rats, used in the manufacture of inks and dyes and explosives and wrinkle-proof fabrics, home insulation, and is a major constituent of embalming fluid, and injected into the delicate body of a baby. What could formaldehyde, aluminum, phenol, mercury, and any number of other deadly chemical substances used in vaccines possibly have to do with preventing disease in children? The fact that they are needed at all in the vaccine formula argues that the product is toxic, unstable, unreliable, and without this wouldn't work, unquote. Let's just take a look at the threat of thimerosal. On July 9, 1999, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a statement urging removal of the mercury-containing preservative thimerosal from vaccines. The reason behind this strong recommendation is a growing concern about the risk of exposing the developing brains of infants to mercury. And while the precaution is certainly welcomed, I would ask, why was such a dangerous, known neurotoxin allowed into vaccines in the first place? Mercury exposure has been associated with nerve cell degeneration, adverse behavioral effects, and impaired brain development. It has also been linked to a degenerative chronic condition such as Alzheimer's. The developing fetal nervous system is the most sensitive to its toxic effects, and prenatal exposure to high doses of mercury has been shown to cause mental retardation and cerebral palsy. And yet, the CDC is currently recommending the mercury-containing influenza vaccine to all pregnant women. And furthermore, until vaccine manufacturers comply with the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations, vaccines containing thimerosal will still be given to infants, children, and adults. And other mercury-containing vaccines include hepatitis B, pertussis, diphtheria, tetanus, and hemophilus influenza B vaccines. Now, mind you, this is all well documented in the scientific literature. I could refer you to Public Health Service, Volume 48. I could refer you to Brain Research, Volume 784. I could refer you to Neurotoxicology, Volume 18. And these all show you the dangerous effects of this upon children. Just look at the title of the articles. Widespread neurological degeneration in rats following oral administration of methylmercury during the postnasal development phase. Neurobehavioral effects from exposure, dental amalgams, new distinctions between recent exposure and mercury body burden. A review of methylmercury in child development. Prenatal methylmercury exposure in children, neurologic development and behavioral research. So the research has been there. On my last program, I showed the fact that all of the people who are on the CDC board of advisors, their so-called objective blue ribbon panel, were anything but objective. They all had conflict of interest. Many of them were owners of actual vaccine patents. Many of them receive money directly from vaccine manufacturers, and therefore they should have excused themselves from being on such a panel. It didn't seem to bother the FDA because the FDA panel was equally stacked with people with gross conflict of interest. So when you are told that the vaccine is safe and effective and that the FDA and CDC stands behind it, ask, is this the same CDC that thought so little of human beings and especially of African Americans that they allowed syphilis to go untreated in an entire generation of them? Yeah, same CDC. Is this the same FDA that allowed untested vaccines to be used in over 700,000 Gulf War service personnel? Yeah, same FDA. American Academy of Pediatrics statement acknowledged that with the growing number of vaccines mandated for children, the cumulative levels of mercury exceeds that deemed safe by current guidelines. When was last time your pediatrician or your physician told you that there was mercury in your vaccine and what that mercury could do Now, if you got a hepatitis B, hepatitis A, polio, pertussis, diphtheria, or tetanus vaccines, you're also getting formaldehyde, a highly carcinogenic material used to embalm corpses. And while the hepatitis B, hepatitis A, pertussis, diphtheria, and tetanus vaccines also contain aluminum, were you told that you were getting aluminum, embalming fluid, and mercury into your body or into the developing babies? No, you were not. That is gross irresponsibility. Can we be surprised that a growing number of children are manifesting cognitive disturbances such as autism and attention deficit disorder? What is not reported in the mainstream media? What is not shared before most congressional funding committees and oversight committees? What is not discussed in any of the halls of the FDA or CDC? Vaccine failures. I'm going to go into some depth on the failures of vaccines. Remember, everything I'm reporting is fully documented. Every single statement is footnoted, and you can go to the GaryNoll.com webpage, and there you can see every single citation from mainstream peer-reviewed journals, whether it's the European Journal of Pediatrics and the volume on articles. Every single statement comes from quality resource sources. A look back through history reveals very different stories about vaccines from the ones told today. In fact, medical literature documents increases in the conditions they are designed to prevent, as well as side effects of all degrees of seriousness, including death. Thus, the statement we hear so often from the medical establishment that vaccines are safe and effective is an out-and-out lie. It is a gross distortion, and I challenge any scientist or any physician who states unequivocally that vaccines are safe and effective, prove it. Prove it. Plain and simple. Where's your evidence? You haven't got it. And if you look for it, you wouldn't find it. The medical literature has a surprising number of studies documenting vaccine failures. Measles, mumps, smallpox, polio, HIV outbreaks have all occurred in fully vaccinated populations. In 1989, the CDC reported among school-age children, measles outbreaks had occurred in schools with vaccinating levels of greater than 98%. They have occurred in all parts of the country, including areas that had not reported measles for years. The CDC even reported a measles outbreak in a documented 100% vaccinated, fully vaccinated group, and yet there was an outbreak of measles. A study examining this phenomenon concluded, quote, "The apparent paradox is that a measles immunization rates rise to high levels in a population, measles becomes a disease of immunized persons," unquote. Quote, "These studies suggest that the goal of complete immunization is actually counterproductive, a notion underscored by instances in which epidemics followed complete immunization of entire countries. Japan experienced yearly increases in smallpox following the introduction of compulsory vaccines in 1872. By 1892, there were 29,979 deaths, and all had been vaccinated. Early in this century, the Philippines experienced their worst smallpox epidemic ever, only after 8 million people received 24.5 million vaccine doses. The death rate quadrupled as a result of the vaccine program. In 1989, the country of Oman experienced a widespread polio outbreak 6 months after achieving complete 100% vaccination. In the United States, in 1986, 90% of the 1,300 pertussis cases in Kansas were, quote, adequately vaccinated. 72% of pertussis cases in the 1993 Chicago outbreak were fully up to date with their vaccines. In addition to vaccines not doing what they were meant to do, another type of vaccine failure is the side effect. Vaccine manufacturers do try to minimize side effects occurrence by listing in the product literature the conditions that contraindicate a vaccine's use. But there are a lot of contraindications, and doctors aren't always aware of them. Dr. Scribner has documented just a few of the specific contraindications listed by the vaccine manufacturers in their product inserts. For instance, By the way, for all service personnel, were you ever told the side effects of a vaccine? No. Were you ever told that you had an exemption right? No. Were you ever told that if you had any medical condition that could be causing the vaccine, A, not to work, or B, to cause additional adverse reactions, you should not take the vaccine? No. So the idea that people are being properly informed that the vaccine, even if it did work, may not be right for that person based upon the medical condition that person has, is extremely irresponsible and, I believe, grounds for massive litigation against the individuals involved. For example, I'm going to quote directly and verbatim from the manufacturer's own inserts. Then I want you to ask yourself, listen carefully, because we're setting the stage. Did the nurse in your school inform you of this? If they did not, that may be construed as a form of malpractice. Did your doctor inform you of this before vaccinating you? If not, a form of malpractice may be construed. Did the hospital in which you work as a nurse inform you of these adverse side effects? Think well on this. Quote, for the DPT vaccine, hypersensitivity to any component of a vaccine, including thimerosal, a mercury derivative, is contraindicated. Routine immunization with DPT should be deferred during an outbreak of poliomyelitis. The occurrence of any type of neurological symptoms or signs, including one or more convulsions, seizures, following administration of this product is contraindication for further use. Use of this product is also contraindicated if the child has a personal history of seizures. The presence of any evolving or changing disorder affecting the central nervous system is a contraindication to administration of DPT, regardless of whether the suspected neurological disorder is associated with occurrence of seizure activity of any type, unquote. Now, how many parents have had their child immunized with DPT vaccines where the child has had some form of a central nervous system condition? And if you want it, here's where you get into the paradox. On the one hand, psychiatrists have been ever increasing the number of just normal, everyday, let's say, lifestyle events that they're now considering signs of mental disorders. And so you would be hard put to find a kid in the United States that did not have something that could be considered within the central nervous system. And they say, and whether it is suspected of being associated with seizures is not the issue. That means almost every child that's given the DPD vaccine could have been given should not have received it. Here's another one. For DTaP vaccine, quote, influenza virus vaccine should not be given for 3 days, within 3 days of the administration of the vaccine. Quote, for MMR vaccine, quote, due caution should be employed in the administration of MMR to persons with a history of cerebral injury, individuals or family histories of convulsions, or any other condition in which stress due to fever should be avoided. For OPV vaccine, immunization should be deferred during the course of any febrile illness or acute infection. In addition, immunization should be deferred in the presence of persistent vomiting or diarrhea or suspected gastroenteritis infection. Prior to administration of the vaccine, the attending physician should warn or specifically direct personnel acting under their authority to convey the warnings to the parent, guardian, or other responsible person of the possibility of vaccine-associated paralysis, particularly to the recipient, family members, and other close personal contact. The responsible adult should be informed of precautions to be taken, such as hand washing for diaper changes, after diaper changes. For the HIB vaccine, hypersensitivity to any component of the vaccine, including diphtheria toxoid or thimerosal in the multi-dose presentation, is a contraindication, unquote. Now, I've got a question for you. How would you know whether or not you have a counterindication or allergic reaction to thimerosal? When was last time, practically speaking, I realize politicians never think of this, medical bureaucrats, they don't have the capacity to think of it. Doctors are intellectually devoid of this capacity. But somewhere, someone has to pay attention to their own legally binding and legally enforceable statement. Let me repeat this. Hypersensitivity to any component of the vaccine. That means aluminum, mercury, and thimerosal. How would you know? Since we do not have regular testing for chemical sensitivities, allergic sensitivities, for any contraindications to any of these in our society. So they're saying, hey, if you have a sensitivity to this, don't use it. It could be dangerous. That's good. But then, how would you know? You've never been tested. Does that mean then that you are exempt in your responsibility? No, it's not. Because any responsible doctor then would say, let's first do some studies. Let's do some tests to see whether or not you're going to react to any of these additives. Then they test you, and then they see if there's a reaction. And if there's no reaction, then at least they have complied with the package insert. If they have not done those tests, then your pediatrician could be held liable for malpractice for introducing into you. Now, all you parents who have had what you believe injury to your child following vaccine, listen carefully what I'm telling you, because I'm giving you the legal basis for suing your physician and your school nurse. I definitely believe school nurses should be sued. When they have not done this, school should be sued. The entire school board should be sued, especially sue your school teachers. Just sue everybody capable of being responsible in the process of making decisions. It's the only way to get someone's attention. And they're going to say, well, I didn't know. Oh, you did know. You were so confident that you were willing not to allow a child to come to class unless they had this vaccine, but you are not willing to say, do you have any counterindicated effects? Did you get proper informed consent? You can't play God with people's lives if you're not willing to be responsible for the negative consequences of that excess use of power in the way that we do it within our hierarchical structure. For the Varicella-Zoster vaccine, quote, pregnancy should be avoided for 3 months following vaccines. Vaccine recipients should avoid using aspirin for 6 weeks after vaccine. Now, I got a question. How many pregnant women have been given the chickenpox vaccine and then took aspirin because they didn't know not to? These are all part of your legal rights for recourse. Let me give you some specific effects of vaccines. The diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine. First, the diphtheria vaccine. In the 15 years following the introduction of diphtheria vaccine in 1894, the number of deaths in England and Wales rose 20%. Between 1895 and 1907, there were 63,249 cases of diphtheria in individuals who already had been vaccinated. There were 8,917 people died who had been vaccinated. That's a fatality rate, death rate of 14% in vaccinated people. In the same time period, there were 11,716 cases not treated with the vaccine. Of those, only 703 died, or a death rate of 6%. So here's what we have. The group that was vaccinated had more than twice the death rate than the group that was not. And the number of people who developed diphtheria who were vaccinated jumped by 63,000. In 1926, the American Medical Association started a drive to abolish diphtheria by 1930. Despite their efforts, states pushing the diphtheria vaccine the most had the highest death rates of diphtheria by 1930. Michigan had one of the highest rates of inoculation, and it had the highest level of deaths from diphtheria. In 1928, a commission looking into childhood deaths in Austria reported that 18 out of 21 children who received the diphtheria toxin became ill. 12 subsequently died. From 1941 to 1944, the Scottish Ministry of Health admitted that over 23,000 cases of diphtheria occurred in vaccinated children, and that over 180 children died of the disease who had been vaccinated. In Germany, compulsory mass immunization commenced in 1940. By 1945, diphtheria cases had gone up from before 1940 of 40,000 to the 1945 250,000 cases. In Hungary, where immunization had been required since 1938, there was a 35% increase in the number of diphtheria cases in completely immunized children. Geneva, Switzerland fared no better. In 1933, when mandatory vaccination was enforced, the number of cases tripled in a three-year period. A more recent tragedy took place in Naples, Italy, in July of 1978, when a number of children were vaccinated with diphtheria tetanus toxoid. Within 24 hours, they were admitted to the hospital. Five of the children died. 59 additional deaths occurred within a period of 8 months. And this is all supported. All you have to do is read the different scientific literature. Now let's look at a different vaccine. Let's look now at the acellular pertussis vaccine. Until 1996, the whole cell vaccine was the only whooping cough vaccine available in the United States for children in their first year of life. This vaccine included all the components of the bacterium Bordetella pertussis, including the toxic ones, and the administration of this vaccine was associated with higher rates of adverse effects. It was the acknowledgement of the risks associated with this vaccine that prompted Sweden and Japan to suspend whooping cough vaccinations. When Japan reintroduced the vaccine in 1975, it was with the recommendation that it be given to children who were at least 2 years old. This policy was followed by a sharp drop in the reported complications. The public, however, still would not trust the vaccine, and immunization coverage remained low. This lack of acceptance provided the impetus for the development of a new, purified acellular vaccine. The acellular vaccine was tested in the late 1970s and proved to be safer and more immunogenic than the wholesale one. From 1981 on, the only vaccine used in Japan was the acellular one. And you can read about that in Clinical Infectious Disease, June 28, 1999. Despite the fact that a safer vaccine was available and widely used in Europe and Japan, it wasn't until 15 years later that the United States changed its policy and started recommending the acellular vaccine. 15 years is a very long time, especially if you consider how many children have been unnecessarily hurt and killed to protect the interest of vaccine manufacturing companies. In 1996, the purified acellular pertussis vaccine was finally approved by the FDA for the use in combination with the diphtheria and tetanus toxoids for all doses in the vaccination series. The vaccination schedule now requires children to receive the first three doses of DPT vaccine at ages 2, 4, and 6 months, and with the fourth dose at around 15 to 18 months, and the fifth at 4 to 6 years. Until the change in schedule becomes completely effective, both vaccines, the wholesale and the acellular, can be used, with the acellular being preferred. A study published in 1996 by Dr. Rosenthal and Associates showed that the rate of adverse reactions reported to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System during the early 1991 to 93 dropped from 9.8 per 100,000 vaccine doses to 2.9 per 100,000 after substitution of the acellular pertussis vaccine for the whole cell vaccine for the fourth and fifth doses of DPT vaccination. Seizures and hospitalizations were about four times more likely to occur after vaccination with the whole cell vaccine compared to the acellular one. And that is in the Archives of Pediatric Adolescent Medicine, Volume 150, page 457. Now, the following is a list of articles documenting the reduction in the rate of complications occurring in children injected with the ACEA rather than the whole cell pertussis vaccine. And these articles also show that the ACEA vaccine is more effective than the whole cell when preventing whooping cough. The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, and that is volume 8369, page 122. This study shows that the ACEA pertussis vaccine is not only as effective as the whole cell type, but also less than one-tenth as toxic. Use of this vaccine has replaced the whole cell vaccine in Japan since 1991. From the archives of the Pediatric Adolescent Medicine, volume 150, page 457, this study shows that the whole cell pertussis vaccine is associated with a significantly higher rate of adverse reactions, including seizures and hospitalizations, compared with the ACEA one. In particular, the rate of reported adverse reactions per 100,000 vaccines was 9.8 in children per 100,000 receiving the whole cell and 2.9 in those receiving the ACEA. And the rate of hospitalizations and seizures with the whole cell vaccine was much higher. From the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 334, page 349, the Swedish trial tested the efficacy and safety of the ACEA versus the whole cell pertussis vaccine, even though, according to the authors, quote, because of the concern about safety and efficacy, no pertussis vaccine has been included in the vaccination program in Sweden since 1979, unquote. Well, the whole cell vaccine was found to induce significantly higher rates of protracted crying, cyanosis, fever, and local reactions compared to the ACEA vaccine. Furthermore, after three doses, the whole cell vaccine conferred protection to less than 50% of the vaccine recipients. And from the Annals of Tropical Pediatrics, volume 16, 139, this randomized controlled trial evaluated immunological response, persistence of antibodies, and the adverse reactions in children receiving the whole cell TPT vaccine versus those receiving the acellular TPT vaccine, and their local reactions and fever occurred in 2% and 8% of the children, respectively. New England Journal of Medicine, volume 334, page 341. The study evaluated 14,751 children who randomly received the whole cell or the acellular pertussis vaccine, and found that the efficacy of the whole cell pertussis vaccine was only 36%, whereas that of the acellular vaccine was 84%. In addition, the whole cell vaccine was associated with significantly higher rates of local infection. Now, before I continue on, let's just evaluate something here for a moment. For 15 years, Japan and other countries found that the whole cell vaccine, the whole cell TPT vaccine, should not be used. And they didn't. And they used a cellular vaccine. When did you hear any story or were told by people giving you the vaccine, as this was reported by the New England Journal of Medicine, that the most you could expect to be protected by the whole cell pertussis vaccine was 36%? And which 36% would it be? If you have 100 kids lined up, you can say, all right, here's what's going to happen. We're going to give you, because we're 15 years behind the rest of the world, not because we have bad science, but because we have to make sure we don't offend or cause any lawsuits or any undue spotlight on what's wrong with our vaccine manufacturing, because the vaccine manufacturers have to pay lobbyists. The lobbyists have already put money into political campaign chests. They've already paid for special physicians and pediatricians to tout the praises. They've got all their boards of consultants at every government level all packed in. So it wouldn't look good. It'd be a house of cards that would crumble. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to have 64 of you receive no benefit whatsoever. None. And we're also going to say that of those receiving no benefit, you're going to have a high percentage of reactions, including death. But it's worth it because 36% of you, and we don't know which 36%, could be conferred a protection. Would you, the public, have accepted that? Would you have said, okay, yeah, I'll risk my child's life to maybe be one of the 36 that will be protected from getting whooping cough? Or would you say, how many kids die of whooping cough who aren't vaccinated? Oh, well, that'd be an intelligent question. You'd find out it's less than those that were vaccinated. You think, well, what's the advantage? And what are the side effects? You see, you were never told, and that's why I'm citing these studies. The Tokay Journal of Experimental and Clinical Medicine, volume 13, page 103, talks about the proof in both Canada and the United States, a resurgence of pertussis has been documented since the late 1980s. In 1993, for example, when pertussis vaccine coverage in the United States was the highest ever registered, we also had 5,457 cases of pertussis, reported the CDC. That's the highest peak ever reported since 1967, and it just happened to come after everyone was vaccinated. National, state, and urban area vaccination coverage levels among children ages 19 to 35 months in the United States, and that was reported. The status of pertussis do not paint a picture of an efficacious vaccine. In the United States, the incidence of pertussis declined steadily during the 20th century until a law was passed in 1978 requiring proof of immunization of all children entering primary school. As a result of this immunization law, vaccine coverage has been 95% since 1980. But from 1980 to 1986, the overall incidence of pertussis tripled. Would your politician be interested in those statistics? Will the news media be interested? Or they go to the CDC and the FDA as they normally do and be given an assurance that everything's fine, or go to one of the scientists associated within one of the vaccine companies and be assured everything's fine, therefore not print the material. So here's what it comes down to. We didn't have a problem with pertussis until they started mandating compulsory vaccination. And within a period of just 6 years, we had a 300% increase in pertussis. Let's take a look. The following is a list of only just a few of the articles documenting the failure of the whooping cough vaccine to protect vaccinated individuals from contracting the disease. New England Journal of Medicine, July 7th, 1994. The study reports an outbreak of pertussis occurring in Cincinnati in 1993, where approximately 80% of the infected children had received 5 doses of the vaccine. 80 of the 255 children who were contracting the disease, as 31%, were hospitalized. The authors concluded, quote, since the 1993 pertussis epidemic in Cincinnati occurred primarily among children who had been appropriately immunized, it is clear that the wholesale pertussis vaccine failed to give full protection against the disease, unquote. But you don't read the New England Journal of Medicine. Your doctor should, but did they tell you? Another article from the peer-reviewed journal, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, September 5th, 1997. The article gives details of a statewide outbreak of pertussis in Vermont in a highly vaccinated population. The outbreak affected primarily school-aged children and adults. From the peer-reviewed journal Vaccine, February 15th, 1997, this study reveals that during an outbreak of pertussis in Nova Scotia, Canada, 93% of the affected children had received their vaccinations. Vaccine effectiveness was estimated to only be 25% in children who received their doses of vaccine. That means it was 75% ineffective. From the Journal of Tropical Pediatrics, March 1991. The article reports on an outbreak of pertussis occurring in Cape Town, where 33% of the population of 239 children with 95% vaccine coverage developed pertussis. The Israeli Journal of Medical Science, March 1991. This article describes an outbreak of pertussis with 78 cases occurring in a population of 964. all fully vaccinated, living on a kibbutz. When an active surveillance system for the detection of cases of whooping cough was initiated in Nova Scotia, in Canada, the incidence of disease was found to be 9 times higher than what had been estimated the previous year based upon passive reports. 91% of the pertussis cases had received at least 3 doses of vaccine. Researchers concluded, quote, pertussis remains a significant health problem in Nova Scotia despite nearly universal vaccination, unquote. From the Journal of Pediatrics, November 1989, 2 things emerged from the Nova Scotia experience. One is that pertussis vaccinations prove ineffective, and the second is that reported cases of disease can vary greatly with the reporting system used. Claims of pertussis vaccine success are not based upon data collected through active surveillance of the incidence of the disease, but on the extremely inadequate system of passive case reports, a system that grossly underestimates the real incidence of pertussis. It is disturbing to contemplate the consequences of this for the millions of American children who, on the basis of such faulty data, are forced into being vaccinated. When parents bring their child in for vaccination, they are told by the doctor that the vaccine is effective when clearly, clearly, scientific evidence shows it is not. Also, they are told that the vaccine is necessary to prevent the wide range of complications that children could incur if exposed to the disease. Again, science, the facts, proves otherwise. Malnutrition, overcrowding, and lack of basic sanitary measures seem to be by far the main determinants of the potential complications of whooping cough. And these factors are not ameliorated by vaccination. This is well described in a 1985 study evaluating the frequency and severity of whooping cough in Britain in the period from 1972 to 1983. According to the article, outbreaks and severe cases of pertussis occurred consistently only in a few areas of deprivation. Approximately 30% of the cases occurred in fully vaccinated children, and the vaccine did not offer protection to children older than 4 years of age. And during an 11-year period, there were no deaths due to proven or suspected cases of pertussis. In addition, between 1975 and 1982, no cases of encephalopathy, permanent brain damage, or lung damage occurring among children surveyed or hospitalized. The authors conclude that, quote, in children living in non-deprived circumstances, meaning healthy circumstances, in Britain, the risk of pertussis vaccine during the period of 1970-83 exceeded those of whooping cough. In some deprived sections, the risks for whooping cough might have been marginally higher, but there was no evidence that this was associated with any increase in deaths or permanent disabilities, unquote. What does that tell you? And that was an article entitled Whooping Cough and Pertussis Vaccine, a Comparison of Risks and Benefits in Britain During the Period 1968-83 by Dr. Stewart and Associates in Developmental Biology and Standards. What that means is that as long as a child had good healthy hygiene, proper nutrition, good healthy water, and sanitary environment, they didn't come down with pertussis, whooping cough. There were no deaths from it. There were greater risks of coming down with the disease and dying from it if you were vaccinated. Now think of this. Think of Bill Gates willing to spend billions of dollars to vaccinate poor children in Africa. Imagine when you already had a highly compromised immune system, you're suffering from gross neglect of your nutrition because they don't have proper and adequate nutrition, water, and hygiene, and then you introduce a vaccine. I'm suggesting that Bill Gates will be committing genocide. And unfortunately, because I hear he is one of those singularly closed-minded people on listening to anything of an alternative perspective and believes absolutely and completely in the orthodox approach, rather an oxymoron considering his background, that we have a person willing to use their money, supposedly for good intent, but with a wrong-mindedness. Better his money be spent, the billions he was going to do on vaccines, and you can bet there's a lot of money being made from the insiders in that loop. Why not go in there and help the children by reestablishing proper nutrition and agriculture and infrastructure and wells. We're going to do it in one village. That's all I can afford. I'm doing it myself, but I'm putting in a well and a greenhouse, buying seeds, and teaching classes in organic farming and biodiversity farming and sprouting, and to help them in one village to see what the results are. And it's not that expensive. Certainly it wouldn't be for people of Bill Gates to spend the money, and you could virtually change the whole health of everyone in Africa if you did that. And you would suddenly see then other so-called infectious epidemics would be decreased substantially. Pertussis vaccination has also been shown to increase susceptibility of certain individuals to the infection. As a 1997 CDC report clearly describes, in the Netherlands, children are vaccinated at ages 3 months, 5 months, 11 months with a diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, and inactivated polio vaccine. It's called the DPT-IPV. By 12 months of age, 96% of the children have received at least 3 shots of pertussis vaccine. Despite the high levels of immunization, pertussis has been endemic in the country for the past 2 decades. In 1996, a sudden outbreak of pertussis occurred throughout the country, with the incidence rising from 2.1 cases per 100,000 in 1995 to 18 cases per 100,000. Now, this outbreak was unexpected, since epidemic cycles occur every 3 to 5 years, and a recent 1994 outbreak had just occurred. The incidence of pertussis in areas with low vaccine rate coverage was comparable to those of areas with high immunization rates. And while the average vaccine coverage did not change, the proportion of vaccinated patients who contracted the disease increased from 55% in 1989 to 85% in 1996. In particular, the study found that the incidence of pertussis among unvaccinated children 1 to 9 years of age actually decreased in 1994 and 95 compared to 1989-90. In contrast, the incidence of the disease in vaccinated children was considerably higher in 1994-95 compared to the early period. So what this means is that those kids that were vaccinated had a higher degree of the disease. Those kids not vaccinated did not. Now, these data suggest that unvaccinated children become more resistant to the disease while those who are vaccinated become more susceptible. It seems possible that circulating strains of B. pertussis have become less sensitive to vaccine-induced immunity. A change in structure of B. pertussis has been documented by molecular typing, and it's possibly due to the introduction of wholesale vaccines. And furthermore, antigenic variants of B. pertussis distinct from the strains incorporated in the vaccines have emerged. Vaccinated children seem less capable of responding to the variant strains than those who have not been immunized. And that's from an article entitled, Despite High Levels, this is entitled Pertussis in the Netherlands, an outbreak despite high levels of immunization with wholesale vaccine, emerging infectious diseases, volume 3, page 175, 1997, Center for Disease Control. We have much more to share on this particular series, but I don't want to go into another topic on today's show. I want to be able to have that fresh for another show coming up. A lot more information. By the way, if you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346. Program number today is 2619. That's 888-317-2346. And today's show number is 2619. For our stations around the country, we're ending our show a little early today due to some technical glitches in New York, which caused our program to run a little short. But we will be back tomorrow with a full-length program. Just one short comment today as we complete this show. First, I'd like to thank all the people in the audience who supported BAI in our fundraising. I believe we did very well. And also, just a special acknowledgement to my brother, Stephen. He never seeks any acknowledgement. In fact, I wouldn't have known of his last deed unless I found out through a friend. But my brother was responsible, was the responsible person for helping to organize the environmental scientists, the largest conference ever attended in India. And through that, they managed to get lead out of the gasoline in India for the first time. He then went down to the Dominican Republic and had thousands and thousands of kids checked for the blood levels of lead, which is very deleterious to their growth and development. And because it was shown that they had high such lead levels, was able to go down there recently, and through a great deal of scientific promotion, was able to get the Dominican government to ban all lead in gasoline. And then this past week, my brother took down the first heart-lung machine ever in the country of Dominican Republic, plus over $1 million in free medical supplies to their hospitals. He just never stops helping work to make it a better world. And he does so all through his own efforts, in his own time, and his own very limited financial resources. So a very special for all the people in the Dominican Republic who now will have their life saved. And a team of 10 doctors, my brother's organized, including thoracic surgeons, to go down in January to show them how to use this heart-lung machine, the only one they ever had in their whole country. And here's my brother who spent 25 years helping on these issues. So job well done, Steve. I'll see you all tomorrow.